Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we consider trending news stories and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. This week we'll be taking a closer look at this year's United Nations General Assembly, the issues raised, and asking a key question. Is the UNGA fit for purpose in a rapidly changing world? As emerging geopolitical alliances solidify, is the UN itself reflective of these changes or even relevant anymore as a forum for addressing issues like war, poverty, Islamophobia and multipolarity? Here's a brief look at the key events from this year's summit in New York.
The General Assembly is the main policy-making organ of the UN, where member states engage in a multilateral discussion on a spectrum of international issues. In its 78th session, Muslim leaders use their platforms to discuss major concerns affecting the Ummah while proudly proclaiming their faith. Iranian President Raisi spoke at length against the erasure of family values and the rampant Islamophobia spreading across Europe, displayed clearly in the desecration of the Holy Quran.
These understandings that bring unity and divine teachings that inspire, that build human characters, that build societies, that build progress for human societies will never be burned, is eternal. They remain impervious. The fires of disrespect will not overcome the truth, the divine truth.
Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey stress that Palestinian statehood is a necessary element of any potential for peace in West Asia, while simultaneously making plans and shaking hands with Israel.
The signs of xenophobia, racism, and Islamophobia turning into a new crisis have reached alarming levels in the last 1 year.
2023 has been the deadliest for the Palestinian people in the past 15 years. How can people trust in global justice while settlement building, land confiscations, and home demolitions continue? Where is the global solidarity to make UN resolutions believable?
Elsewhere, representatives of several Muslim-majority African nations warned against any Western plans to attack Niger following the expulsion of a French-backed regime there.
Any military intervention in Niger, any aggression or any invasion of that country would pose a direct threat to the peace and security of Mali and of the region, and it would necessarily entail grave consequences. We will not stand idle.
This year's theme was to be rebuilding trust and reigniting global solidarity. But with open discrimination and acts of aggression perpetrated against Muslims, is rebuilding trust between nations a genuine possibility?
Now, joining us today in the studio to talk about all these issues is a regular contributor to the show, Batul Sobeti. Sister Batul is a political activist and commentator whose incisive analysis helps both laymen and professionals alike navigate political developments on a global scale. And joining us on Skype from Tehran is Ali Salam. He's a convert to Islam and editor-in-chief of Basira Press, with a focus on West Asian affairs and reporting on global capitalism and the Great Reset. Thank you both for joining us on today's show. Now, let me begin here in the studio with yourself, Sister Batul. You've been following the events, of course, of the UN General Assembly and also the fallout from that summit. What did you make of this year's event?
To be honest with you, I don't think it's any different to any of the previous years. You can almost script what the PMs and the presidents are going to say. Ultimately, the UNGA is an expression more so than it is real action. You can think of it as almost like a PR networking event. Nothing is really in the hands of the leaders who are invited to speak. Unless, of course, you are a part of the UN Security Council and you have the veto power. That's where real action takes place. And, of course, the majority of those in those permanent positions are the Western Bloc. So you have the US, the UK, France. And you have to see this, obviously, within the context of the formation of the UN. It was formed post-World War II by the victors of the war. Of course, and the Soviet Union was an ally back then. Of America and the UK. But ultimately, the function of the UN was for those emerging superpowers to have monopolization over the world. It was never meant to be a platform to ensure equality, to ensure proportional representation. And even if you see, for example, the leader of the UN, you see that the kind of stance that he takes or she takes is really that mimicking the American strategy. Even when it comes to, for example, a large power like Russia that actually has a position in the Security Council and has the veto power, they still mimic that American strategy, for example, when it comes to the war on Russia via Ukraine. So that's the reality. Nor does the UN actually represent those rising powers like Iran that actually have real programs for change. So it certainly doesn't represent that axis. But what I would say is, whilst it's important that we do talk about institutions like the UN that exist, those are increasingly becoming outdated. It's very important that we look at the transformations that are happening on the global sphere, and we recognize that actually we're having alternative parallel systems that are forming, you know, whether that's, you know, BRICS and the interconnection of the banking systems, whether that's the Shanghai Cooperation Council, whether that's the International North-South Transportation Corridor, and understand that actually these are alternative systems that are balancing the G7, EU, NATO. Yes, of course, in real terms, they don't have the same level of strength as of yet, but it's the trajectory that we're going in. The Western fist is increasingly disintegrating, and the Global South nations are rising, and they're a lot more specific when it comes to their policies, unlike the UN, that's a lot more general.
And I actually really want to pick up on a few of those points, especially to do with, you know, the new organizations that are growing. But I do want to just pass over to Tehran and to Brother Ali Salam. Thank you so much for joining us from Tehran. Now, one of the most iconic images we saw, and we saw it in the video just earlier, was of President Ibrahim Raisi of Iran holding up the Quran to, you know, to defend its honor. And as he said there, to say that all the incidents of its desecration would never take away from the value of the Quran. What did you make of the president's speech? And do you think the rest of the Islamic world is really doing enough both to protect the Quran and to push back against all of the type of Islamophobic provocations that we've seen?
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, wa bismillahirrahmanirrahim shuhada. I thought it was actually the most powerful thing of the whole entire UN General Assembly, because no other Islamic leader would do such a thing. And as you said, it's about who is really, are they really doing enough to combat the Islamophobia that's going on? Some Muslim countries, alhamdulillah, they did various boycotts of Sweden, but I think the most powerful demand was from the leader of the Islamic Revolution, who stated that these people should actually be brought to justice, the specific individuals, not any kind of collective punishment of the Swedish people, but the specific individuals and officials who are responsible for this heinous crime. Because the Quran is really the cure for all of the material and the spiritual problems that exist in the world today. Because so many isms have come and have offered their so-called solutions for humanity, whether it be capitalism or Marxism or all these different kinds of isms. And they only address the material issues, but the Quran really addresses both those dimensions. So I think it's very important that we understand that the Quran is like the cure for people's hearts. And to censor that cure, I heard an Islamic scholar refer to it as being equivalent to censoring a cure for cancer. And the first thing that came to my mind when he said that was that they actually do that. This satanic system of these arrogant powers, they censor both the physical cures for cancer through the pharmaceutical mafia and then those same rich, wealthy families that control much of the resources of the world. They use their media power and their cultural power to then censor the spiritual cure for the spiritual ills of mankind. So to stand up for the Holy Quran when no other world leader would do so is a true mark of the adherence of the Islamic Republic of Iran to the noble values of Islam.
Thank you so much, Brother Ali. Sister Batul, I do want to come back to you. And also, again, another really interesting scene we saw at the UN General Assembly was the failed attempt by the Israeli delegation to disrupt President Raisi's speech, as Brother Ali so eloquently analysed just there. Now, that ended up with the Israeli ambassador being unceremoniously kicked out of the hall and removed by security. And that's in addition to Netanyahu giving his speech to an almost empty hall at the Assembly. Do you think that represents the world's feeling on Israel, that they're becoming more isolated?
Absolutely. It goes back to the roots of the creation of the Zionist entity. The Zionist entity was created to play that functional role to secure Western interests in the region, to actually protect Western interests. But right now we're in a situation in the world where the wrong state is increasingly becoming a liability to the West, specifically to America, of course, because even America's priorities and its strategies have shifted. Right now, we are increasingly seeing the withdrawal of America from West Asia, of course, as its priorities shift elsewhere to secure its unipolar hegemony and its fight against Russia. So actually, the West, specifically America, is more interested in the region kind of being used to fight China and being used to fight Russia. That's why today, when we look at the normalization of ties between the Arab states, specifically Saudi Arabia, that is increasingly on the cusp of normalization, we don't see this as a victory for the Zionist entity. We don't see this as a sign of strength, because actually this would have never happened if it wasn't for America. America wants this to happen. Why? It's within the increasing strategy of creating a balance within the region. As America is withdrawing, it wants there to be kind of a more united opposing camp that can secure its interests, of course, in the face of the Islamic Republic of Iran and its camp. So really, in this state of affairs, Saudi Arabia is an entity that doesn't really have the power to say no. It doesn't have the power to do anything but to follow through on the American orders. The same exists for the other Gulf states, for example, like the UAE and the likes of Morocco and Sudan, that normalized those relations. It cannot be, and it should not be seen as a sign of strength, because they were never enemies with the wrong state to begin with. It's just a matter of relations going from being under the table to being over the table to secure the American interests within that frame of reference that they're leaving the region. So even it's important that we don't look at America as this kind of victor in this situation or as having the upper hand. Actually, on the world stage, we're seeing the disintegration of the American fist. So of course it's going to forego the Zionist entity that it created to protect it when it's a sinking ship.
Thank you. Now, we spoke to Islamic scholar Jafar Ladak about the UN General Assembly, and in particular we wanted to ask him about what Muslims should be doing to stand against the type of Islamophobic provocations we've been seeing across the world in recent months.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We are experiencing actually an increase in provocation, especially around the burning of the Quran, which is actually being seen at an international level, sadly. And we realize that the provocation is probably divided into two. There's those people who are provoking the Muslim community out of ignorance, and then there are those people who are provoking the Muslim community out of hatred and spite. Both of these two have to be dealt with in a slightly nuanced fashion. Those who are with ignorance, the Quran mentions that we have to be able to treat them with a softer approach, whereby we understand that they have been manipulated by the forces around them. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions in the Quran that we have to call people with a particular stance of bil-hikmati wal-mawdi'ati al-hasana. So we need to call them in the most befitting wise of ways. We also, according to the Quran, need to try to turn people who are ignorant, كَأَنَّهُ وَلِيُّ الْحَمِيمِ, into sort of turn them away from their enmity in towards being closer in proximity and devoted friends. On the other side, there are those people who are doing this out of spite, and they're doing this with knowledge, full knowledge of what they're trying to achieve with this spite and with this enmity. And the Quran takes a much tougher stance with such individuals. So when provocation used to occur with the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, for example, you will even see that a declaration was responded to them in the opening of chapter number 9, Surah At-Tawbah. God says you have a certain amount of time to repent and turn with your ways, otherwise we will respond. Similarly, His Eminence, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, may Allah bless him and preserve him for us, in one of his statements in the recent weeks and months, stated that the practitioners of the burners of the Quran in Sweden, they should be arrested and turned over to the international community, particularly to the Muslim nations, for such people to be held responsible for their provocations.
Great words of advice from the Sheikh there. Now, Brother Ali, I wanted to come back to you. The recent months, we've been seeing the expansion of BRICS, Iran restoring ties with some of its Arab neighbours, Saudi, the UAE and others, doing trade, other countries doing trade in currencies other than the dollar with each other and so on. Now, is the UN really reflective of these rapidly changing events? Is it even relevant anymore? And or does it need massive reform to give more influence to the rising powers of the global south?
As our respected sister had stated, that the UN is, its mechanism is designed to protect a certain group of powerful countries that existed at a certain time in history following the Second World War. And the world has rapidly changed since then. But in my humble opinion, I believe that the UN was set up to intentionally be biased towards a handful of powers, namely the United States, the European superpowers, and as well as the emerging Zionist lobby that had not yet formed the illegitimate state of Israel at the time. And so it's essentially a front to be a source of false hope for the nations of the world to settle their disputes. It puts a face of being neutral. It puts a face of being a sort of international body for settlements of disputes between different nations. But as has been mentioned, there's no proportional representation. The Security Council only represents a handful of powers, and the majority of those are on one kind of alliance of certain nations that have a particular agenda. So it really is an irrelevant organization. And while BRICS and SEO are promising and offering an alternative, they're mostly economic alliances. They don't have any kind of ideological alliances, and there's no also an international system for settlement of legal issues, issues of justice, issues of prosecuting criminals, like, for example, the desecration of the Holy Quran or the assassination of Martyr Qasem Soleimani. And I think since we're here talking about, we're in an Islamic show, and perhaps so many of our audience are Muslims, the UN's framework is entirely secular and liberal, and that framework is not what is best for the well-being of humankind, because human beings have both a material reality and a spiritual reality, and there needs to be a system in place that addresses both of those. So in my humble opinion, I believe that the world is moving towards global government. That is the inevitability. It's just which type of global government, a kind of satanic global government that may perhaps represent the kind of false messiah that Muslims and Christians believe at the end times. But then there's also a global government that will be led by the divine representatives that God has placed on earth, namely Imam Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and Jesus Christ, whom both Muslims and Christians are waiting for. And they will lead a divine global government that does not oppress people, that does not usurp people, that does not cause all kinds of problems and chaos and misery in the lands. So we essentially have two competing global governments that are that we can really see playing out right now in these various alliances between different countries that represent a very satanic agenda, that are covered in the blood of millions of innocent people around the world, and countries that are seeking to liberate humanity from such wicked and evil powers.
Thank you, Brother Ali, and some really interesting points raised there. In particular, the kind of, I guess, the binary nature of, you know, you have the Western or pro-Western or more Western-leaning institutions. For example, you've got the United Nations General Assembly. And then Brother Ali there was talking about, you know, you have to set up alternatives to that. You know, what kind of vision do you want from the world? Would the solution be, for example, giving countries like Iran, South Africa, India more power on the Security Council, or should those nations be pushing on with their own institutions, in particular, for example, alternatives to the SWIFT financial system, so that countries can freely trade with each other without having to worry about you know, sanctions and other oppressive measures.
Absolutely. The trajectory that we're seeing is, as was has been mentioned, that the UN is increasingly becoming redundant, outdated, and those countries are taking the matters into their own hands. So, for example, you're seeing the interconnection of banking systems between China and Russia, for example. 70% of their trade currencies are in the rubles or within the yuan, which is the Chinese currency, for instance. You're seeing also the same thing happened with Iran and Russia, for example. The interconnection of their banking systems, I believe over 50 banks in the previous year have connected alone. So the reality is these nations don't wait. They take the initiative. What binds them and what unites them is the American hegemony on these nations. They see their struggle as one struggle. And that's the interesting reality, is that America is shooting and has been shooting itself in the foot for the past three decades. You can argue that it's actually, the American empire is probably the most short-lived empire. When you think of empires that ruled the world and had that kind of unipolar fist, a lot of them were for hundreds of years. But with America, we're seeing it's for 30 years because the reality of its oppression is unsustainable. These nations, they have programs for change that they want to bring forward. And they have demonstrated that. As Brother Ali rightly mentioned, the Islamic Republic of Iran, for example, is an entity that has an ideological change program. What really threatens America and has threatened America since the start of the revolution was this ideology itself. What threatens it with respect to Russia and China is just a matter of status. Like, they don't want them to overtake them in the sphere of, like, the numbers, for example, whether that's the army, you know, whether that's economically. But with the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's bringing forward an ideology that's fighting the central ideology of capitalism, where money is the god. And right now we're seeing the attack is so much more greater on just Islam. What we're seeing on the world stage is an attack on all moralities. It's an attack on everything that's objective, on all objective frameworks. It's to create a world that is fluid, subjective, where anyone can be anything, can identify with anything. Raisi also spoke about the attack on the family institution, for example. The whole aim is to create a world where they can reshape and they can reconfigure it in whatever way shape they see fit. And that's why the EC stressed to the UN, please have a program where you protect the family institution, the attack on the family, the attack on sanctities, for example, because all of that, the UN yielding to that or not giving in to those demands is really serving the American project. And we know it's just an outlet to serve the American empire.
Sure. Thank you, Sister Batul. Brother Ali, we've only got about a minute or so left, so I do want to ask you the final question. Now, you know, you've stressed, as has Sister Batul, on, let's say, the values that we've seen at play around the world. And it's not, you know, just perhaps even between Islam and so-called Western values, because actually, even though Muslims and Islam is now being seen as a alternative to that system, we're seeing many people in, you know, traditional societies in the West who have had enough of this agenda. So very quickly, you know, what should Muslim institutions be doing, Muslim nations be doing, to show that actually we have, or the Quran has, the solutions for these, you know, values and these global ills that we're seeing?
The main thing that they should do is live by the Quran in practice. We saw so many of these Muslim leaders, they say Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, they talk about Palestine, but then they go to shake hands with Netanyahu. Or they want to sell Palestine out in the name of Palestinian statehood through the so-called two-state solution, which still recognizes the illegitimate Zionist occupation and gives them a part of the land that they stole. So we need Muslim leaders who are not hypocrites, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, to lead the way. And the main thing that they should do to resist the satanic temptations that are seeking to create an entire system, an entire lifestyle, which they already exist. They've already built it, but they want to globalize it and make it sure that there's no square inch of land or square meter of land on Earth that exists without such a system. And the main vehicle for that is the UN 2030 agenda, which through its so-called sustainable development goals seeks to spread LGBT in the school curriculum.
Thank you, Brother Ali, for your time today, and to Sister Batul Sabeti here in the studio. That's all we have time for this week. Thank you. And you can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, we're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. Stay tuned.
انسان‌های شیطان هم هستن این آیه قرآنشه شیاطین الانس والجن این آیه قرآنه ها
In the Holy Quran Surah Al-An'am Ayah 112 we read This is how for every prophet we appointed as enemy the devils from among humans and jinn who inspire in each other with flashy words deceptively According to this ayah, we even have also devilish humans who are created to deceive others. Bad friends, unbelievers, and enemies of Allah will distract the person from the right path. If a good person can invite a bad person to the right paths, it's okay. But if he or she is not successful, such a friend must be left.
توانی می گریز از یار بد بدتر بود از مار بد تنها تو را بر جان زند یار بد بر دین و بر ایمان زند
In a beautiful Persian poem we read run away from a bad friend since he is like a poisonous snake even worse than a snake since the snake only bites your body however a bad friend bites your faith and belief. Most of the guilty people in the prisons had bad friends. We must either guide the bad friend or escape from him or her. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S. will send depleted uranium arms to Ukraine despite the risk to civilians. The weapons have been linked to spikes in birth defects, miscarriages, and cancer. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Reuters, the Biden administration will send controversial armor-piercing munitions containing depleted uranium to Ukraine. The munition can be fired from U.S. Abrams tanks, which are expected to arrive in Ukraine in the coming weeks. The shells, which will come from U.S. excess inventory, would be funded by the Presidential Drawdown Authority, which lets the president make transfers from U.S. stocks without Congress's approval in the case of an emergency. Truthout also wrote the news follows an earlier decision by the Biden administration to provide cluster munitions to Ukraine despite concerns over the dangers such weapons pose to civilians. If the U.S. deploys depleted uranium shells to Ukraine, Russian President Vladimir Putin has threatened to retaliate with DU rounds, which are linked to birth defects, miscarriages, and cancer. Depleted uranium is a byproduct of the production of fuel used in nuclear power stations. Its extreme density gives rounds the ability to penetrate armor plating easily. The use of depleted uranium munitions has been fiercely debated, with opponents like the International Coalition to Ban Uranium Weapons saying there are dangerous health risks from ingesting or inhaling depleted uranium dust, including cancers and birth defects. Common Dreams also reported the U.S.-led NATO coalition that waged the 1999 air war against Yugoslavia also used DU munitions, which experts believe are responsible for a surge in leukemia in the region, both among the local population and foreign troops deployed in the war zone. Peace groups have long campaigned for a ban on DU munitions. Last September, the United Nations General Assembly approved an Indonesian draft resolution urging further research of the health risks and environmental impact of DU weapons and calling for a cautionary approach to their use. The resolution was approved by 147 nations. The US, UK, France, and the Zionist regime voted against the proposal. Ukraine will soon receive American uranium munitions capable of destroying heavy Russian tanks, according to media reports. According to Sputnik, the controversial depleted uranium shells, whose toxicity and detrimental effect on the environment have been a cause of concern since NATO and the U.S. used them in Kosovo and Iraq, respectively, have once again been thrust into the limelight. This time over news about the potential supply of depleted uranium shells to Ukraine. Depleted uranium is a dense metal that possesses exceptional properties for military applications. Its high density makes it ideal for armor-piercing projectiles, as it can easily penetrate thick armor. Additionally, depleted uranium is self-sharpening, which means it maintains its shape and penetrative capabilities upon impact, making it highly effective against armor targets. Depleted uranium has been extensively used in military conflicts since 1990s. It has found its place in various ammunition types, including rounds, shells, bullets, and armor. Its effectiveness in penetrating armored vehicles and fortifications has made it a preferred choice for anti-tank weaponry. Sputnik added, one of the primary concerns is its potential health and environmental impacts. When depleted uranium projectiles strike their targets, they release fine particles of uranium dust, which can be inhaled or contaminate the soil and water. This raises concerns about the long-term effects on both human health and the environment. One of the most debated questions is whether depleted uranium is radioactive. While depleted uranium is less radioactive than natural uranium, it still emits low levels of radiation. However, the main health risk associated with depleted uranium is not its radioactivity, but rather its chemical toxicity. Studies have shown correlations between exposure to depleted uranium and various health problems such as cancer, birth defects, and kidney damage. NATO forces used depleted uranium ammo in Yugoslavia and Iraq, where now surging rates of cancer, including cancer among children, have been recorded. NATO troops are also suffering the effects of these ammo, since their commanders failed to inform them about the potential health risks.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to all the enlightened listeners of IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab, your devoted host, ready to take you on a captivating journey through Islamic upbringing. Together, we'll explore the challenges and questions surrounding raising children with Islamic values. Experts' insights rooted in the noble Quran and the teachings of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family, will guide us along this path. Well, today we have Brother Miqdad in the studio. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Very warm welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Well, we have been talking about how to instill faith in your children from a couple of episodes. And Brother Miqdad told us that he would guide us through seven easy steps, and we talked about there should be a good family life, there should be parents instilling habits with patience and lenience and manners. Then the third point that we talked about was creating the sense of belonging in their children through creating a strong Muslim identity. And then we talked about the mosque centrality, how mosque could play a central role in their lives. And then we talked about growing in knowledge. That was the fifth point, where Brother McDowell said you should create a thirst of knowledge in your children and then equip them with the right knowledge so that they have answer for all the doubts, create an understanding, and parents should understand that their children are living in a world where they can face with the individuals who are from different faith or individuals who doubt a lot or question a lot. So for that reason, children should be equipped with enough knowledge, and they should understand the purpose of life. They should understand why they follow a particular sect or a particular religion, and they should have a proper understanding about all these facts. Now, these were the five points Brother McDowell guided us through. What are the other points to instill faith in our children?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The sixth point that I'd like to mention in relation to how to plant the seed of faith in our children is what we call active with a sense of achievement. What I mean by this is that one of the things that we need to realize is an idle mind is the source of a lot of bad things. An idle mind, a mind that is not active, a mind that has a lot of free time, will naturally be inclined towards moral vices. We'll be naturally inclined towards doing things that are wrong, doing things that are not befitting the human perfection. And so a very important point over here is to always make sure that we keep our children busy. We keep our children active in different activities.
Right.
And the more we do this, the more we involve our children in different activities, we're avoiding the situation where they are in a state where they've got nothing to do, where they feel bored, or they don't feel that they have anything to do, right? On the contrary, you find that these children who are active, they're always busy doing some things. Obviously, in a balanced way, certain things are physical, certain things are mental, certain things are social. A different balance of different activities, but the whole day they are active doing certain things. They're not idle, wanting to spend their time on the phone, just going through social media or watching TV, just snapping this video from that video, or just roaming around the house not doing anything. The more we keep our children busy, the more we really helping them to then have a sense of achievement, which I'll talk about, and really pave the way for a strong faith.
Yes, that was really very important, and it really needs efforts for parents to, you know, instill those things into the child, to keep them busy with better things, to keep their mind occupied, to keep them occupied physically. Well, we'll talk more with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English Radio @irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We are with Brother McDowell, and we're talking about how to instill faith in your children. We talked about 5 points, and now we're discussing the 6th point. The brother said there should be active life in our children, and they should not have idle or free time. So brother is giving us more explanation.
The point that I want to really bold and emphasize is the sense of achievement. One of the things that really stands out in children that have faith and that maintain their faith and are strong in their faith is the amount of self-confidence that they have or self-esteem that they have. And we find this in Islam as well, that Islam talks about the izzah of the nafs, right? The mu'mineen, the believer, has a sense of izzah, the sense of honor, the sense of value, the sense of feeling important. And so we need to create this sense of feeling important and feeling that they have value in our children. And this can be achieved through being active, through seeing the results in their efforts. Okay. And this is why when I said the 6th point in terms of faith, it's active with a sense of achievement, that we involve our children in different activities. And by being active and then seeing the fruits of their activities, this brings about a sense of achievement. They feel productive.
Okay.
Children that are idle, children that are lazing about, not doing anything, they don't feel productive. And that leads them to then feel unimportant or feeling unworthy or feeling that they don't really have an important role to play in this family or even in society. And this then leads to them towards negative things and away from the faith. Islam wants children to grow up feeling that they have a sense of responsibility, that they are important for their family, for their community. And this is when they see that when they're active, they are doing certain things, and these things are having a positive impact on them and also a positive impact on others as well. And when they see this, they have a sense of achievement, a sense of productivity, which then leads them to then having a good sense, a good feeling about themselves. And this leads them to then
being a better human being who is helpful for the family and as well as for the community.
So in order to achieve this, a couple of points. Firstly, obviously, when we talk about not being idle, it requires us to really place the television and mobile phones and computers and laptops as something that is not central to our family life, right? TV can be watched. We watch cartoons and movies, etc.
But should be screen times.
There should be time for it, and it shouldn't be central to our life, right? We do a lot of different things, and then sometimes we also watch TV.
Okay.
That's firstly. Secondly, as much as you can, involve your children in different activities in a balanced way. So it can be sports, as much as we can involve children in sports, especially as they grow older, right? Children who are 9, 10, 11, 12, and then entering teenagehood, it's essential that they do plenty of sports, right? It should be good sports. So football is not always the best of sports. Martial arts, gymnastics, swimming, they're very important sports. As much as we can involve children in sports is really important. It really plays a big part in not just their physical building and their physical growth, but also their emotional growth as well, the psychological growth as well. Sports should be a big part of our children,
right?
Both for boys as well as for girls as well, although boys more than girls.
Right. So we'll talk about the topic more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Brother McDowell, and we're talking about some beautiful points. How to instill faith in your children? Well, we are discussing the 6th point. Brother McDowell said he will guide us through 7 points. The 6th point is being active with a sense of achievement. Brother McDowell said it's not really good that children are idle, because the idle mind is actually a house for shaitan and negative things come in. So we should be trying as parents to make our children busy as much as possible, and watching television screen times and all, that should not be the main time. That should be involved in the leisure time. And they should make use of their time beautifully through different ways that Brother Miqdad guided us. So, Brother Miqdad, what more is there?
We talked about sports. Keeping and involving children in sports is very important. But not just sports. As we said, it's important to keep them active in different, in a balanced way. So, involving children in learning different skills is also very nice. So, sometimes related to arts, so drawing, sketching,
Calligraphy,
for example. You also have computer science, programming, video editing, all these things related to skills that are related to the computer, AI, etc. So there's different types of skills to encourage our children to take part in these classes, in these workshops. Allows them to feel this. One is that they're active, two is a sense of achievement is built because they're learning a lot of skills that they can then use in the different activities they're involved in, whether it's at mosque, whether it's at home. The point being is that children after school and after their homework and after their reading should be active. A child's day should be filled. Okay. It's a very nice scene that I mentioned before as well, that children, when it comes to nighttime, they should be really tired. They should get into bed with a sense of tiredness and a sense of like, I've done so much today and I need to go to sleep.
Right. So they should get this sense of sleep themselves by being so active during the day. And parents should help them see the sense of achievement by helping them be more productive, having that feeling of being productive for themselves as well as for the community. That was all time we had for today. Thank you so much, Brother Miqdad, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And you can also go to the official website to listen to our programs, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, Call of Islam, and you'll find an archive of our programs there. In case you want to listen to our programs on social media platforms, just search Call of Islam Radio. Thank you so much for listening. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.